This is very much descriptive and instructional and commanding of a spirit of a community. And the purpose of our talks tonight together is not to establish a community. We're all going to sell our stuff, move out to Corona or Lake Havasu or somewhere. But, and I'm not going to even really talk a lot on community. That's not the point of it. But in conjunction with what we saw and what I just shared, these practical admonitions and requirements are very much talking about relationships. Relationships regardless of whether people physically live together or not. The relationships have to be grounded on the same thing. And these are much of that. Verse 9 says, "Let love be without hypocrisy." What would you have if you had love without hypocrisy? What would you have if you had love without hypocrisy? Excuse me?
Love.
Yes? So what would you have if you had love without hypocrisy? You would have love, but without hypocrisy. What does that suggest when it says it like that? Ron?
Honesty.
Honesty? In what way? What is your mind seeing? Honesty.
I think it's just the purity of love and love to be known and love to be hypocrisy is taints love.
Is what love?
This taints love.
Taints love. You're saying purity? Transparent. Now, what is the significance of transparent in regards to honesty, in regards to hypocrisy? What? Why is that contrary or opposite of hypocrisy? Well, yeah, if it's without hypocrisy, then it's transparent. So why are those opposites? Well, in your mind, hypocrisy and transparency, why is that opposite? So hypocrisy is putting up something you can't see through so that you don't know what's behind curtain number 1, 2, or 3, right? So to speak. Whereas transparency is you've got a curtain maybe, but it doesn't block the view. Transparency is you can see right through it. Isn't that wonderful to have a relationship with somebody that you can almost see right through all their actions and you have a confidence that you know their heart and what it is. Come and go high and low, in and out, see them off and see them not. But there's some kind of without hypocrisy that you can just see the motive operating by its tenderness, by its strength, by its sternness, by its forbearance, as opposed to some kind of cloud over them that you just can't seem to make contact with the person. You just, you know, what would love with hypocrisy be? Well, you'd have something you couldn't see through. You're just more there than meets the eye, and you can't put your finger on it. Purity, you said honesty. What you see is what you get. Love without hypocrisy. If you had love without hypocrisy. What is hypocrisy? What is hypocrisy? What's the idea of hypocrisy? Okay?
Say you have something and you don't. You are pretending.
Hypocrisy is pretense. Hypocrisy is to say you are one thing, but you're not. Hypocrisy is a false confession. Right?
Yeah.
You're confessing, you're saying that something is so, it's not so. To deceive, it's to be deceitful. Hypocrisy is deceitfulness. But love without hypocrisy, would that not be equivalent to entire sanctification? Wouldn't that be just another way of saying holy? We're entirely sanctified. A holiness without anything mixed in it to take out any purity, so that it is just... I mean, this is just one more way of saying be entirely sanctified. Be completely holy. Be pure in your love. Not mixed with anything, so that if love is the fulfilling of the law, which is chapter 13, verse 8, right around the corner, and let it be without hypocrisy, what more holiness or purity could you have than love without hypocrisy? What improvement can you make on that? As far as character goes, nothing. And that's all that the Bible is concerned about. That's all that the law is concerned about. It's all that God is concerned about is character. Heart of the character of holiness is love. And if it's without deception, if it's pure and it's honest and it's totally transparent, so that there's nothing other than what it really is that appears to be or pretended to be or claimed to be, there's nothing that would be more than that that God or the law would require. Let love be without hypocrisy. This month there is need for gospel truth and us as people to talk straightforwardly, courageously, carefully, diligently about where we've been and where we're going. A lot of things have happened in the last year. It's a year ago when we met together and said, shall we start meeting as a church? Shall we who meet as a Bible study start meeting as a church as well? Was the way it was put. People said yes. People said this is what I would commit myself to, and I will support it with finances. I made commitments there. And it's been a year. It's been a long year, and it's been a short year. Both. And we need to take a wonderful look at it and make some thinking on it and look at what we've been through and think hard about what changes we may need to make, as I suggested before, how to overcome some of our difficulties. See what it is that our commitments will look forward to. The, in my opinion, most significant thing, Gospel Truth Fellowship, is relationship. Gospel Truth Fellowship is nothing other than relationships and a means for those relationships to do something else. Gospel Truth Fellowship is simply, as I pointed out at the beginning, for some that were here and for you that were not, Gospel Truth Fellowship, meeting together on Sunday morning and together and during the week and renting a place, whatever else may happen, is designated as a means. As a means. To furthering the will of God, to doing the will of God, to expressing love for God. Like these people have created these communities at Bethany House and at the National Conference Center. Gathering together in a community is but a means. And since as long as they held it to be a means to something else, it has been successful and fruitful. Because without Bethany Publishers, a lot of major material would never have been published, including Finney's stuff. And had that happened, most likely I would yet be in my sins and not saved. Because what they published was the means that God used to save me. So they kept it the means, not an end. It's not an end in itself. The gospel truth is not an end in itself. It does not have a life in and of itself that must be preserved at all costs. It is not something that exists that must be sustained at all costs. It is a means. It is not something that must be sustained regardless of the character of the people involved. For gospel truth to explode in attendance and the number of people attending, but to be led by people that do not love God with all their heart, is not what gospel truth fellowship is about. It would be a betrayal of its premise and of its design. But relationships are what moral agents is all about. We are not about the bodies that we live in. We are not about the things that are in this world that God has given for us to use for good and for our own comfort. But what moral relationships are about is relationships, one with another. And the core, the heart of relationships is love. Love without hypocrisy. And through the last year, relationships have come and gone. Have risen high and risen low. But that's the core of it. What is our relationships? What have they been over the last year? That is the core of my preaching. That is the core of my counsel. That is the core of my time spent with any one of you, or all of you in preaching. It's what is our relationship? What is the relationship between you and I, and your relationship and my relationship with God? And I preach on love, I preach on the moral law, I preach on moral government, I preach on the gospel, but it all has to do with relationships. And the gospel is a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. It is nothing else than relationship. And that word can be used so much, relationship, that it begins to lose its meaning. But that is the crux of it. Do you as a moral agent, do I as a moral agent, relate to other moral agents in love without hypocrisy or on some other basis? Now, I observe and have observed that people have different ideas of what constitutes a relationship. By examples that they follow, that they've been raised up in, that by and large, if they've been raised by people who do not love God, the relationship skills, relationship definitions, are in themselves faulty. Because they are learned from people who do not love God, and the relationships are not benevolent, and not love without hypocrisy. They are selfish. Their end is selfish, their means are selfish, and people define their relationships and how to relate to one another by people who are not benevolent. So it becomes that when a person hears God's law, the gospel, the relationship that God commands people to have with Him and with others, this is something new that they have not learned in their homes or anywhere else. It requires going to the Scriptures. It requires hearing the truth. It requires applying the truth and throwing out all the things that one has learned that is not based upon what love is. Now, I use the terms moral law, I use the terms moral government. And those are not just phraseologies to use to say, here's a wonderful doctrine we have and these are the elements to it. Those words are describing love without hypocrisy, relationship. Let love be without hypocrisy. Let your relationship be one between you and I and one another. There's a loving relationship without hypocrisy. We had a service a week ago. It had to do with confession. We had a study on Wednesday night regarding confession, Sunday morning service regarding confession, and a time of confession. What was that about? What is a time when somebody makes a confession? They're removing the hypocrisy. That's what it ought to be. If it is not removing the hypocrisy, it is removing the hypocrisy, either that one is saying, I am not what you think I am and I still am that, or I was not what you thought I was, but I have repented of that, and now I am what I profess to be, but I haven't been that. Confession is taking the hypocrisy out of what they were proposing that they had was love, taking it out and making it love without hypocrisy. That's what confession is. Let love be without hypocrisy. Let a profession of love be without duplicity, pretentiousness. Let it be honest, pure, transparent. And confession says, I haven't been that way. I haven't been transparent. I haven't been honest. As I said in the teaching, that when there is love with hypocrisy, then it is no longer love. Paul is making the case as the way he makes it. But where there is hypocrisy, it is a willingness to let another person believe a lie, that which is not the truth. So love with hypocrisy is dishonesty. And then it would lose its definition, or true meaning is love. Through the year, through this last year, there has been love, and there has been love with hypocrisy. There has been professions of love that has had hypocrisy in it, and there's been professions of love that has truly been benevolent. Through this last year, there have been commitments made by people who didn't keep commitments. A year ago, there were people who made commitments to be here, to be supportive, to make gospel truth something that they are a part of, that they would be gospel truth as much as anybody else would be gospel truth fellowship, that they would support it with their finances as well as their efforts and their devotion as a means to glorifying God. And they're not here today. They're not here today. Now, it is one thing to make a commitment to be in a relationship with another person and break that relationship or change the relationship legitimately. Let me give you an example. Somebody walks in and starts attending and we get to know them and they say, this is where I'm going to make a commitment to serve God. This is where I'm going to make a commitment to be supportive of ministry, people, have a relationship of love one with another, be a servant one to another. This is where I'm going to give my time. This is going to be church for me. I am going to be church here. Might be a better way to say it. I am going to be church here. This is where me as a member is going to fit into this body and serve. A year later, 2 years later, after faithfully serving and keeping that commitment, person comes and says, God has called me. God has called my family to mission work. God has called us to another place. God has called me to a different kind of work that will take us out of the area. And we've kept our commitment until the changes come to be necessary. And now, we have to leave. And that is how relationships legitimately change. Other people, however, come in, make a commitment, professedly the same, get disgruntled. They do not get what they want. Just get disenfranchised, whatever it might be, and they just stop coming. You don't end relationships by just ceasing to have them, because that's not a relationship. You don't end a relationship by just ceasing to be there. Just because you get disgruntled or unhappy personally, you just don't walk out of the house from your spouse and your children. You don't end relationships that way. That's not permitted. That is an unlawful ending of a relationship. I don't mean the laws of this country. I mean the law of God. Because when relationships are created under God's government, under the moral law, they are forever. Moral relationships are forever. So the person that I was telling you about who would be for a year or two and keeping his commitment and having love without hypocrisy, fulfilling all of his promises, serving, that relationship would be forever. And the reason why that person would come in and say, there has been this change, and I must go someplace else, and I can no longer serve here, but I will be serving somewhere else. That relationship doesn't end. It just changes. So you don't throw it away by just stop coming. You go to the people you have a relationship with, whether it's in church, work, families, and you say, there's been changes that have to occur. This doesn't mean the end of our relationship. It just means the end of being able to have it near each other or work together on something. But it's not over. Because relationships are forever. When a spouse walks out on another spouse, that relationship isn't over. It's just been butchered and betrayed. But the relationship is there. It's just not being honored. It is love with hypocrisy. You cannot get rid of relationships that have begun. They are forever hold their obligation to maintain them rightly. And if there are changes, they have to be made to change them lawfully and honorably with respect to the needs of the other and the good of the other. That's why a church that is wonderfully developed and prospering, when people have to leave, they come and present themselves and the people send them off in the name of the Lord, and those relationships, if they never see them again, have not been severed, just changed. Do you see that? You see that? Our culture, this world, this sinful world, just picks them up and throws them away. Like an old jacket, like an old coat. Relationships. Use it as long as you can use it, and throw it away when it doesn't serve your own purposes. That's not moral relationships. Moral relationships are not a jacket, a coat, a hat. They are moral beings. I owe you my love. I am indebted to you. Paul says in 13:8, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. But look at the terminology he uses. Owe to one another your love. I owe you love without hypocrisy. You owe me love without hypocrisy. You owe each other love without hypocrisy. Amen? Amen. So that when there is difficulties, if one's spiritual state encounters trials and testings and falterings, that relationship needs to be without hypocrisy. When there is victories, those need to be testified to. When there is falterings, time to let it be known. So that I can have a real, true relationship with you, or vice versa. Ron and I had an opportunity on the trip, a few hours here and there, to talk about things that, subjects that came up due to relationships that he was encountering and things that were going on. There were some wonderful discussions and real life drama right in front of us in these various relationships. Let love be without hypocrisy. For example, I'm thinking of something specific, but I don't want to say it specifically, so I'm trying to figure out how else to share it. It was drawn from an illustration on our trip. Briefly, may I share in skeleton? Briefly, shortly before Ron and Kim left the area. In a relationship that they had with somebody, that person took offense at something. And then Ron and Kim left shortly after that. And Ron did not know until we went back there that for a year and a half this person had held that thing against Ron. And as a result did not write to him and Kim, did not tell him that they had taken offense. And Ron was under the impression that everything was okay. He could tell it wasn't, but he did not know that something was held against him. That's love with hypocrisy. That is not a benevolent relationship. It is withholding the truth from another person. And as we talked about it, he could see in living color some principles. We talked about the love of the truth. When you're benevolent, you have a love of the truth. It is that which brought you to conversion. Nobody gets converted until the truth comes and leads them out of selfishness and leads them and presents the gospel and the character of God before them. And by embracing the truth, one is set free from the bondage to things, appetites, desires, themselves. They're set free through the truth by believing it. So there's the love of the truth because that's what set them free. There's the love of the truth because by walking in the truth, one remains free and has communion with God. The same is true with others. If you know, if there's a particular food that would give you incredible energy when you ate it, so that you could do marvelous, wonderful things in this life and just do all the good that you could do and never tire out, and you knew that it was that food that did it, and then you see somebody else that's just weak and tired all the time, and you intended to do them good, what would you do? You'd give them that food, wouldn't you? Because you know that's what would do it. Well, that's the way it is in the relationship of the truth to salvation. Nobody is converted until they've seen the truth of some things, the truth of God, the truth of the law, the truth of themselves. It is the truth that finally leads them out of darkness. When you see somebody else in darkness, you know that the good that can be done to them must be through the truth. So you got to make sure that they hear the truth. And in walking in the light, that's walking according to the truth. And you know nobody else can walk in the light, all of it, unless they have all the truth. So in relationship, if I keep you in the dark about me, you can't walk in relationship to me in all the light. I'm keeping the very means from you that you need to walk in light, in relationships. I'm stealing from you a means that is necessary for you to have a clear, transparent, honest relationship with me. I am forcing a relationship with hypocrisy if I keep from you the truth that I know of, that I know you don't know. So the person who is offended often thinks, I'll just wait till that person comes to me. I'll just wait them out. And people have waited for decades, and that other person hasn't a clue that they've offended you, or they've offended the other person. It hasn't been seen by them. It hasn't been understood by them how that was taken. They just have no knowledge of it. But that other person has kept it quiet. So that when that comes out, you know what it means? The relationship you thought you had never existed. Right, Ron? It never existed in that time frame. Parent, after 30 years, finds out that their child is so angry with them, has such bitterness towards them. Mom, Dad, you did this to me when I was 10 years old and I've never forgiven you. They find it after they've been going to therapy or dream hypnotism or something like that. Parent finds out after 20 years that their child has hated them for 20 years. They just thought that the child had some kind of strange personality disorder. They didn't realize it was hatred towards their parents. You know, an unexplainable personality. Can't figure out why the child acts the way they do. The child had never said, I hate you, and I've hated you for 20 years. It's not a relationship. It is not a relationship. It is not a moral relationship. It is not a lawful relationship. It is a butchered relationship. It is a selfish relationship. It is a relationship in darkness. Because it is not giving the other party the knowledge of the truth regarding oneself. Whose responsibility would it be then for that child who hates his parents never told them, pretended like they loved their parents, pretend like their parents and them had a wonderful relationship, keeping it undercover. Whose responsibility was it to bring it to light? Okay? Child. More specifically in principle, the one who knows. The one who knows has the obligation to tell the other party, there's something between us, and I know it. You might not know it, but I know it. The one who has knowledge has the obligation to make it known. To the person. Not to another person. To the person. To the person. That's part of the problem. Not to third parties. You know what so-and-so did to me? You know what so-and-so did to me? I really hate my parents. To the person. Oh, nothing to anyone except to love one another. The person who has taken offense at another person owes that other person to tell them, I have taken offense at something. This is what you did, or this is how I took it. But there's something come up between us. This world is so used to overlooking things and going on, but having a relationship that is not morally lawful, but just surviving, just doing it because there are family relationships or job relationships, but there's no real communion. There is no real love. There's no real genuineness to it. A person owes that person to let them know if there's something between them. How can two people ever reconcile unless the person lets them know there's something to be reconciled? There is nothing. There is no need to have relationships that are so distant. The only thing is, the reason a relationship is distant because if somebody has something against another and won't tell them. So there's the pretending that everything is fine when it's not. Through this last year, there's been some of that. People pretending everything is fine when it's not. I'm thankful for the confession time. People would be willing to tell that things are not as one might think they are or as one might say they have been. I know that it's possible to attend almost any church and not get along with numerous people and then not make much difference. At least as far as the way relationships are ordinarily carried on. That it wouldn't make much difference. It wouldn't stand out and become apparent. Because everybody's got something against somebody and so they just avoid those people. World type of family structures where you just ignore the conflict, you don't bring it to light, you don't reconcile. But at gospel truth, we've aimed at something different. At gospel truth, we've aimed at forming our relationships with everyone else that's in our life, that's around us, based upon owing them our love. So that when I've gone to people who need to be reconciled, I've based it upon that. That you don't have a lawful right to keep to yourself if you have something against somebody else, but you owe that person to tell them. That you don't have a lawful right to keep unreconciled differences unreconciled if you have knowledge of them. That you owe them love without hypocrisy. Look at verse 10. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Isn't that powerful? Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. That's powerful. Is it not? To actually have a devotion, one of us to another, in brotherly love, If in your view I have not been devoted to you in brotherly love, you owe it to me to come and tell me. If I have fallen short in that, if I have missed the mark in that, you owe it to me to come and tell me, so that I can correct that. Paul, in application, after he goes through the first eight chapters and then talks about the subject of what's called election and things like that, he comes to chapter 12 and starts to make practical application of what it means to be dead to sin and alive to God, what it means to be walking in holiness, what it means to be born again, what it means to be walking according to the Spirit, not according to the flesh. And he starts to make application and tell us exactly how it is applied to our relationships if we know God. And one of these is to be devoted to one another in brotherly love. There is a difference between people who are devoted to one another in brotherly love and people who are not. Do you recognize that difference? Can you conceive of it in your mind? Do you know of it in experience? Have you met people? Are there relationships here that you have that you're devoted to in brotherly love? Do you have relationships that are devoted to you in brotherly love? Paul tells us to have that. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? How would that be practically worked out? How would that be lived out? Does that mean I come over and wash your dishes and wash your car, mow your lawn, take care of your kids? You mean I do that? If you can't, maybe so. Maybe so. It does not mean I take away any of your responsibilities and do them for you, because then I'm harming you. Anytime I step over and take care of somebody else's responsibilities when they're able to, I am hurting them. I'm harming them. I'm breaking God's law. But if you are unable to care for yourself, my devotion and brotherly love to you might require that I do those things for you. If the church, what they do, they set aside funds to take care of those that were widows indeed, who had no support because they had been widowed, they had not remarried, they were older in their years, had served the Lord, had Paul specified certain qualifications that they really had served the Lord, they were not living in sin, and the church was to take care of them, because they were unable to take care of themselves. Devoted to one another. If you're devoted to another person, you just don't walk away. That's what I was talking about to begin with. When people are devoted to one another in brotherly love, they just don't stop coming. They just don't not show. They don't say they're going to see you next week and not show. That's not brotherly love. Because to be devoted to another in brotherly love is to be highly concerned about their well-being. And if somebody doesn't show up, you must assume that their well-being is not very good, and it gives you reasons to be concerned. And then you find out, you know, after excuses are made, then you later on find out they just decided not to come anymore. 3 or 4 weeks of excuses, and then finally you find out they just did not intend to come anymore. After you don't see them for several weeks, then you find out all along they had held something against you. But for several weeks they led you to believe that they were sick or something. That's not brotherly love. verse 10 again. Give preference to one another in honor. Now this is not theoretical. This is not Finney's systematic theology. This is not the high systematic philosophical approach to where we could argue over the parentheses and the grammar to whether or not being disinterestedly benevolent referred to the ultimate intention as opposed to the means and go through all the gyrations of the mind. This just simply says give preference to one another in honor. Is that plain? It is, isn't it? That you prefer one another, you prefer the other, and the other prefers you and your good than your own. It's a preference made there. This is Paul's systematic theology applied. Gave a preference to one another in honor. I am willing to go wherever and whenever, according to my ability, to serve you. First, as somebody who loves God, and secondly, as pastor, in that order. I would go with you and serve you in any capacity that I have the ability to do because I love you and I love God. And I wouldn't have to be as pastor. It could be just as another person in this fellowship. Or I could come and serve you as pastor. But I'm willing to do that. I have been willing to do that. But I do it not because I'm pastor, but because I love God. And simply because God requires that of each one of us. Wherever we may be, whatever fellowship a person may be in, God requires that we have this relationship one with another, that we prefer one another in honor, give preference to one another. And my willingness, and my commitment to that, is not higher than the commitment that God calls each one of us to. Not higher. It's just not higher. Not lagging behind in diligence. You know what diligence means? What does diligence mean? Keith, what does diligence mean to you? What's the sense of that word to you?
Carefulness.
Okay, Guy.
Consistency.
Greg.
Persistence.
Kim.
Working hard.
Okay. Pat.
Earnest.
Earnestly working hard with persistence. And with perseverance. Huh? It is a word. It is a heavy and loaded word. Strong word. Diligent. Peter uses it in his epistle. 1 Peter. Second Peter. Look at Peter's use of this word. Second Peter. Chapter 1, verse 5, starts off and says, "Now for this very reason also, applying all diligence in your faith." Applying all, working hard, persistent, perseverance. Verse 15. And I will also be diligent that at any time after my departure you may be able to call these things to mind. Excuse me? Verse 10. Therefore, brethren, be all the more diligent to make certain about his calling and choosing you. It is an applied, persistent, working hard, pursuing after, persevering, significant word. Back to Romans 12. Not lagging behind in, working hard, persistently, consistently, with perseverance, seeking after, whatever, all that means. Don't come behind in that. Don't let it lag. Not lagging behind in diligence. Wherever diligence would be, wherever it would be, in leading out and in working hard and being persistent, don't lag behind in wherever diligence would be. Wherever diligence would be, you be there too. Fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Fervent. You know what fervent means? What does fervent mean to you? Effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Keith? Intense. What else? Fervent. Intense. What else? White hot. White hot. Heated till it's white hot. And steel can get so hot and pour it. It's fervent. Actually liquid. Fervent. Fervent in spirit. Hot. Serving the Lord. I'm suggesting that our relationships and the character of them are the heart of what we are or are not. Rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality. Practicing hospitality. Have you had everybody over to dinner? If it were possible. Practicing hospitality. I take this to be what I talked about earlier. Be devoted to have a spirit of community where you do not pursue nor hold things for yourself, but you have the spirit of community that all things are at God's disposal, serving the Lord as He says. You take things that belong to God and you show hospitality, invite people into your home, use your resources in pursuing the good of others. This is just living practicalities of all the doctrine we've been preaching. I probably have a weakness in preaching, and that is I expect people, when they hear the truth, to live it, to apply it. When I saw the truth and believed it, it made things happen and changed me. It didn't happen to me, but in believing the truth, I changed. And I believing, it necessarily altered how I lived, because we live according to what we believe. It's what we believe that determines how we live. All of our actions come from what we believe. It isn't knowledge that determines how we live, it is what we believe. You can know a lot, but it isn't what determines how you act and how you live. It's what you believe. When I believed the truth, I changed and I lived differently than I did before. I forgot the application I was leading to on that. To Teresa. Thank you. So when I believed the truth, I started living differently. And I believe that what people need is the truth. And if they will believe it, they will start living differently. I'm still persuaded of that. That's the only way for a person to change, to start believing the truth. But I believe that people, if they would hear the truth, would believe it. Let me say it a little differently. I believed that people, when they heard the truth, would choose to believe it. That they wouldn't have to be told to believe it. So I believed that my responsibility was to lay out the truth and labor to lay it out as clear as possible. And then I wouldn't have to go beyond that and say, now, this is how you live if you were to believe this, and impose upon people a control, a list of how to live as though you believe the truth. Okay, here's how you live as though you believe the truth. Until you believe the truth. I believe that it would be hypocrisy. And I could do that. This is how you live if you believe the truth and love God. Here's a list. Take it home, memorize it, and start living. And we'll get around to you believing it as we work on it, you see. But that would be working from the basis of trying to get people to live a controlled life based on outward exercises before they believe the truth. But I had the assumption that if I preached the truth and they heard the truth and their mind affirmed it was the truth, that it would lead to believing the truth, and automatically, this is true, it would change their life. I didn't expect people to hear the truth, to say back to me, I know that's true. I didn't expect them to withhold confidence in the truth. I didn't expect them to not embrace the truth. I expected them to embrace the truth, live by it to the degree they understood it. What I didn't expect is for people to hold it at arm's length, set it up and say, now look at this doctrine, and let's inspect it, let's turn it around here and look inside of it. Let's make sure it's fully developed in our intellect, and then let's debate it with others that don't look at it this way. I think if anything has happened in the last year that has been most distasteful to me, it certainly ranks high in that distasteful list, is at the time, there was a period of time in particular when the spirit of confrontation, the spirit of dogmatizing, the spirit of doctrine debate was flowing quite freely here, and it was disgusting to me. Even though I specifically from the pulpit said that is not what we are about, it continued on because there were some who thrived on that exercise. So the people who came in from CRI to spy out our liberty did not hear the gospel. They heard confrontation, disputations, bickerings about doctrine. They never got to really see or hear the beauty of the gospel as I understand it and as I have been preaching it, I believe. I thought people would be excited to hear that there is this truth that sets people free from sin, that if they saw it intellectually, they would take it further than that and they would start living by it. Lo and behold, people have done here just like they've done other places. They come because their ears itch and they want to see what's new that they have missed. And once they got it scratched for a while, then they decided to leave. They'd rather leave here than leave their sin. I'm sorry for that. I'm sad for that. Because they have come and they've gone and they've not found the answer to their sin. They've not left their sin, and they still are disgracing God. And that still is very distasteful to me. For life or the Christian walk to consist in building up knowledge in order to dispute doctrine with other people. It is still distasteful to me. And if you see me engage in that or have seen me engage in that, I apologize. That is not why I teach, to prepare anybody to dispute with others' doctrine. I teach so that you may live in obedience to God. And once you have been transformed by believing the gospel, you will know that seeking the holiness of others is far more important than winning a doctrinal dispute. You can win a doctrinal dispute with somebody who is going to hell. What have you gained? Nothing. That only puffs up the ego. I was right and they were wrong. I know that Gospel Truth Fellowship and meeting on Friday nights and on here has its tendency to attract people who want to puff up their egos of what they know, not edify themselves in their walk with God, so that they can boast that they know the real truth, even though they don't walk in it. And that's not what I'm about. This is not the means to that. This is a means for personal walking before God in love without hypocrisy, and not building one's intellectual knowledge up so that we can dispute with other people. That's not what Sunday night studies were about. They were for personal application, for personally seeing the truth in its relationship so one could alter their life accordingly, bring their understanding into conformity to the truth. If we were to construct in Southern California in a Gospel Truth Ministry a once a week conference for pastors or professing Christians to come and hear a presentation of some truths, truth of God's moral law, truth of God's moral government, truth of the nature of love, and we were to host it, and 20 people were to come and sit through a series of these teachings, what would they get from us as people? Not from the pulpit as doctrine. What would they get from us as people? What would they, in the character that they observe, think the doctrine is supposed to produce? People who are haughty because they know more truth than others, or people who are humble and servant because they live by the truth that they've heard? What would they see? Sadly, before people have visited and they've not seen servants, they've seen rabbis lording it over other people because able to use the truth as a sword, not to pierce sin, to let in the light, but to destroy a person. Our characters are the most important thing. Our relationships are the most important thing. 20 people come in here and attend these meetings and they hear the truth and they see what love really is, and they begin to apply that to God's character and begin to see that they can trust God because He is love and His character is certainly trustworthy. And they start to believe and they want to come in fellowship. What do? Do they come in to a group of people whose character is not as the character of God, whose character is not as trusting in God would produce? Bless those who persecute you. Bless and curse not. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Paul speaks in wonderful absolute terms, doesn't he? Isn't that wonderful? Wonderful absolute terms. There's no problem understanding the point he's trying to make. Somebody back east gave me a copy of an article out of a journal, a high theological journal. And he says, do you ever read journals? And I says, no, I don't. Well, here's something that might interest you. So he gave me this writing. The man was looking into Paul's writings regarding the law. There's a journal written in the high theological journal of our time, and trying to labor to prove a minute point. But I noticed in his terminology things I've noticed in other people's writings, especially when they try to get in to demonstrate the Greek and the Hebrew and the syntax and the grammar, all those things, you know. After he tried to do it, here's his terminology. Paul may have been saying that such and such is true. It would seem that possibly this is the thing that he was after. The words he uses were not, Paul says this is so, this is the truth of the matter, is this may be the truth of the matter. Perhaps this is the view that Paul is trying to express. And when you get it all done, it's just all perhaps, and maybe this is it, maybe it's not. What use is that? Because maybe if it's not that, then it could be just one of a million other things if it's not that. And if it, perhaps it's this, well, perhaps it's not this. You know? Perhaps bless those that persecute you. Well, perhaps not. Bless and curse not. Well, perhaps curse and bless not, you know. All this relativism and uncertainty about what Paul is really trying to say and what the gospel is really all about. And I'm thankful that God, that Paul is absolute. Never pay back evil for anyone. Evil to evil for anyone. Do not be wise in your, these are just wonderful absolutes. These are as absolutes as the Proverbs are. Just take that. And here's the application of all the systematic theology we've been studying. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. You know what you have to do in order to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep? You've got to know them. They've got to be letting you know if they're weeping or rejoicing. You've got to love them to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Brother Mac Jones lost his wife. Remember that? Okay. I sent him a card. And it was also in the name of the fellowship. Sent him also an offering, as I announced to you. And in that card, among other things, I put, Paul said to rejoice with those who rejoice. And I said, but we also weep with those who weep. And that means you, Brother Jones. Brother Jones shared with me about 8 weeks later that he was praying all night long, weeping at his loss, weeping at the advances he was getting from various women, weeping at the temptation that was proposed, laying before him, calling upon God, God, what is your answer for me in this circumstance of my life? And he said he cried all night long, prayed all night long. He says early in the morning, he says God spoke to his heart, left a definite view in his mind, a definite certainty that God was saying, I will take care of this for you. I have an answer for you. He said he got up, he showered, got ready to leave, and just as he was going out the door, got a phone call from somebody, a lady who he'd known for 20 years, hadn't talked to for several years. She called him. And God spoke to him and said, this is the answer. And they had lunch, and within a week or so he was married to her. He said, God told me. He says, some people in the church, I thought, wouldn't accept that. So we thought maybe we would keep a secret for a year and then let people know we got married. He says, God spoke to me and rebuked me and said, if this is my answer, you can trust me for whatever the consequences are. So he let the church know. Oh, everybody was happy that night. The next morning, started getting phone calls. Brother Jones, lots of complaints. That precipitated one of the men taking all of the fellows in that home that they had away. But that man will suffer and pay. Because he did not keep a lawful relationship. He was subversive. He just took them and left. That's not a lawful way of doing things. But when Brother Jones told me, and he had confidence he could tell me, because he knew of the contacts he had had with people in the fellowship, he knew that we wept with him, and when he told me and shared that with me, he's confident that he could. And I said, Brother Jones, I told you we wept with you when you wept. I want to tell you, I rejoice with you, and you rejoice. Amen. And I did, and I do. I have confidence in him, and what he would tell me, I had confidence it would be true. How can you weep with those who weep or rejoice with those who rejoice unless you're not knowing what's going on in their lives? Unless you're not devoted to them? Unless you're lagging behind in diligence and not fervent in spirit, you won't know what they're rejoicing over or what they're weeping over. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and curse not. Be of the same mind toward one another. How can we do that? Is that not incredible? Be of the same mind toward one another? Does that not say there is a mind that's to be common among all of us towards one another? Does that not say we're not free to have our own devised mind? This is the end of side one. Side two now begins. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Here he is describing what it is. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. You know, you might be wiser than somebody else, but leave that up to somebody else's estimation. That's what he's saying. Let somebody else decide or estimate whether you're wiser than they are, or that if you're wiser than somebody else. Leave that up to them. Don't be wise in your own estimation. Let not your self-esteem say you are wiser than others. Now that's practical, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Do not set your esteemometer to account yourself wiser than others. Does Philippians 2 say, Guy? Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with the humility of mind, let each of you regard, King James says, esteem one another as more important than himself. Use your esteemometer as esteeming one another as more important than yourself. If you considered others more important than yourself, you could not just walk away from them. If you esteemed others more important than yourself, you would be devoted to them, would you not? In brotherly love, brotherly kindness. If you esteem them more important than yourself, would you not have love without hypocrisy? You couldn't be self-centered and esteem others more important than yourself. You can take Philippians 2 and Romans 12 and construct finished systematic theology. It's all there in the spirit of it. The relationships with others is all there in the spirit of what Finney tries to elaborate and demonstrate in the attributes of love and in relationships, what we owe one another. Where do you think Finney got it? Got it from right here. 12, 13, 14, 15, Paul lays out all of what love would do in relationships. It's all there. It's all here. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. How can you pay back evil for evil to somebody? What's ways of paying back evil for evil? Greg?
Doing to them what they've done to you.
Doing to them what they've done to you, okay. What's variations on that, Ron?
Defending yourself.
Excuse me?
Defending yourself.
Defending yourself? Evil, that's right, okay. Evil for evil. This is you, okay. Anybody else, variations? What are some equivalents, but not the same? Pay back evil for evil. I offend you, you ignore me. Evil for evil. Different, but equivalent, right? I cheat you, you slander me. Evil for evil. Different kinds of evil. Not the same kind of evil that you got, but it is evil for evil. Right? Somebody shortchanges you, you slander their name. Somebody mishandles the situation, what do? You ignore them, freeze them out. All depends on how your family structure is and how they gave evil for evil. That's probably what you'll duplicate until you get more creative on your own. That's evil for evil. That can be very deceptive because I'm not doing to him what he did to me, but it's evil for evil. Never pay back evil for evil. What do you do instead? Ron? What verse is that? Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. This is practical instruction manual. This is what benevolence would do. This is the practical way of loving my neighbor as myself and serving God by doing so. Wouldn't you have to have these attributes to live in community with somebody? Live in the same building day after day after day, and other women are teaching your children in the homeschooling? Huh? Another man, you're putting it in the common pot and it's not controlled by you? Other people are deciding how your money is being spent. Don't you need this stuff? If a church is going to be the church, it has to have this stuff. It has to have it in our hearts. Not in our talking, in our hearts. This is the guideline. Relationships are forever. People that have been here and walked away, made commitments and just walked away, affect me. They affect others. Nobody disaffects other people. When people are here and not benevolent, it affects others. When people come, make promises, and leave, it affects others. No different than in your home. When you promise your children what you're going to do for them, and then you don't do it, it affects them. We do not walk through people's lives and not affect them. We affect one another. Therefore, we are obligated to affect them for their good, because we do affect others. We can't help but affecting others. I will forever have an effect upon you. It's too late. And you will forever have an effect upon me. If one of you this evening should die, you will always affect me if I think about you. One way or the other. I will remember and thank God for the memory, or I will remember you in agony. You will always affect me. If I should see none of you again, you will always affect me. And I will always affect you. That's the way we're made. God intended us for to us affect one another, to influence one another, so that we can do each other good. That's how we can do each other good, because God made us to be influenced by other people and to influence other people. As I said before, we don't sign up for influence. We don't have a sign-up sheet that says, you know, you're going to have influence this month, and you're going to have influence this month or this week. You all of us have an influence all the time. How many of you are homeschooling your kids? How many of you are homeschooling your kids? Teresa? Are you homeschooling your kids, or are you homeschooling your kids? Right. Every parent is homeschooling their kids from the day they're born. By the nature and relationships we have, you are homeschooling your kids. You don't decide when you start and when you stop. You, being the parent, are always affecting them. You are schooling them. You are training them one way or the other. And when we create a relationship where we say we're going to be a church, create that relationship, we are always affecting one another. Very differently than if we just all knew each other, had dinner with each other once in a while, or revisited once in a while. It is a different kind of influence. It's the kind of influence where it's different than I live and she lives, and we visit each other. But when we make certain commitments together, it changes the influence we have upon each other. It changes what we rely upon each other for. It changes what we trust each other for. And for a church to be a church, it involves a different level of commitment made to one another, and it affects we affect each other. Why do you think it is so crucial when a high-profile church leader falls into sin? Because it affects everyone. Because there is a natural implication that he is to have made certain commitments in relationship to other believers by being in a responsible position. It speaks louder than a million Bibles could speak of what this Christianity is supposed to be. That's why Jesus said, what was that verse that they quoted? It was this text too, wasn't it? Sunday night, Ron? John 17? By this the world will know that the Father has sent me into the world, by your love for one another. Not by the textbooks and not by the theological books and the systematic theologies, but by your love for one another. By this the world will know that the Father has sent me into the world. Our relationships is what
will determine whether the world will believe that God has sent the Son into the world. That's what Jesus said, right, Ron? John chapter 17, you can all look it up. He also said in the same chapter, "By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, by your love one for another." We all know that one. But he also said in the same chapter, the world will know that that the Father sent him into the world, that he came from the Father, by our love, by our relationship, by our love without hypocrisy, by our brotherly love one for another, our devotion to one another, our diligence, our hospitality, our honesty. That is what will determine whether the world knows through us that God has sent His Son, Jesus, and that Jesus came from the Father. Go home and feast on this, will you? Go home and read it again. Go home and let God teach you from it. Will you do that?